Okay, well, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is the 30th of August, 1983, and I'm with Lieutenant Colonel Herschel Smith in his office in Victoria. And, sir, last day we finished the Falaise Gap incident with Operations Total Lions Intractable, and now we're in, I guess, late August, early September. To begin with, let's talk about what sort of form German resistance had at this point. Were they retreating in confusion after Falaise, or was there a definite line of defense barring the way forward for the Allies?
I suppose on the level which you're asking a broad question as to what the Germans are doing, when you're actually there, your whole sphere is centered on just where you are. You hear what's going on, you read newsletters and so on, but the war itself is really what concerns you, and that's the front that you're on, and so I can't answer that in a broad way. It's for sure the Germans were there. I would say the Canadian Army as such was in pursuit of them, mm-hmm. but again, it was a careful pursuit, because when they stopped, you had to be sure what was going to happen.
All right, then let me ask you a question that's more specific. Where were you after the Falaise Gap had been closed, and what were you doing?
Well, I can't just remember the route of the 4th Division, but wherever that took us, I remember we went through Abbeville. I got wounded in Abbeville, or just outside the darn thing. But we were always, for days on end, just crossing the country, trying to catch up to them.
And they were retreating.
They were withdrawing, and we were going after them as fast as we could, and keeping all the support coming up behind you, and always anticipating around the next corner they'd be there in numbers. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while this would happen, a rear party or something would be there, and they would put up resistance, and stiff resistance, and then perhaps in the night they were gone, and the chase went on the next morning again.
Yeah. Would the resistance take the form of an anti-tank group, or would it be a tank, actually?
Well, I think at that stage it was basically anti-tank. They would leave a gun or two located, and the first tank, or in our case, that came around the corner, he would get fired on. Mm-hmm. And invariably got knocked out. So it was kind of a chase, I guess that's all you could say, for until they stopped.
Mm-hmm. And were you wounded during this chase?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your wound then. This was your first wounding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were following the inevitable, and it got to night, and we were moving at night. Mm-hmm. And it was a very bright moonlight night, and we were up on a very high plateau, and we had a recce officer who presumably knew where he was going. As it turned out, he got lost. And in the dark, you could see tanks were going two different directions.
Your tanks?
Yes, the column was reversing, and you could see against the background that they were there, so we stopped. And it took some sorting out, and I somehow ended up at the front of this thing, because I thought I knew where I was. Mm-hmm. And some people were unfortunate casualties getting off there. But then we went along, and we were... in our group was some Lake Superior Regiment. Mm-hmm. And in the dark, we came up to what looked like a village, and the name of the thing was Cintho. And just we got within perhaps 200 yards of it, and an anti-tank gun let fly at us. Mm-hmm. And that stopped the thing, but at that time, if you ever tried to look through a telescope at night, you can't see anything.
Didn't
you can now.
Infrared.
You don't have it. We didn't have infrared. So he just really pointed the gun at the tank that I was in, mm-hmm. and let fly. Unfortunately, he missed it, and the shell went into the ground and ricocheted over the top. Mm-hmm. And then we pulled up about four or five tanks in a row, and we just let fly at where the gun was, where the town was. The next thing, the town was on fire. Mm-hmm. But little known to us, there was a whole, I forget how many Germans were in this town, mm-hmm. but they saw the town was on fire, and then they started to get out, and we moved up the road, and then they were crossing in front of us. And then all hell let fly then, because then the war was on in earnest. Mm-hmm. And when I say I got wounded, I blew up an ammunition truck, and a piece of shrapnel blew back and hit me in the face. Right there, dead center. Knocked a tooth out. But,
did it concuss you or anything?
Pardon?
Did it concuss you?
No, it knocked the tooth up in the roof of my mouth. But the comical thing was, in the middle of this chaos, and you've got to believe there was chaos, because the infantry were now out on the ground, and when we blew up these trucks, and they were trying to get out by truck, mm-hmm. and there were Germans and everybody in this confusion and shells going off. Somehow, they got hold of a German medical officer. And he was so scared that they brought him over to look at me. And here I got this tooth stuck in the roof of my mouth, and his hands were shaking so badly that finally he got out some tweezers or something and pulled this tooth out.
With no anesthetic at all?
No anesthetic, no. Nothing. And so that's all he could do. He was, once he got that out, at least my mouth felt better, and I had a hole in the mouth, but it kind of cauterized itself because the piece of metal was stuck right in the middle of my lip.
Really?
So when he took it out, it didn't bleed. Mm-hmm. It was cauterized with the hot metal. Mm-hmm. But my tooth, he removed that, and then that was that. So then it got comical because the Germans were going, and they'd taken a whole pile of prisoners, and so another officer of ours had got his foot caught in that turret of a tank. So they put two of us in a tank, and they said they'd run us back to the closest doctor to be looked at. Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing in the dark, we went the wrong direction. The driver didn't know where he was going, and we finally ran right into the Germans again. But we were all alone, and we didn't know where we were. Mm-hmm. So in the confusion, in the dark, we just turned around, went back where we came from, and got out of that mess. But we might, you know, we could easily have all been
captured.
Yeah. It was just idiotic stupidity.
Right? Hey? You're just in a Jeep.
No, we were in an armored car type thing, or scout car. But we were right in the middle of them, and they didn't know what to do any more than we did. We just turned around and drove away.
There's that much confusion.
Confusion.
Yeah.
At night, there's terrible confusion. And only if one guy knows where he's going. I think I indicated to you before that, not that I'm ever going to do it again, but the way to do is to organize these things at night, because first of all, well, they can now with this more sophisticated equipment see in the dark, but the guy that's attacking, he knows what he's going to do. The guy that's being attacked, he's just petrified with the racket and the shells and if anything, he'd like to get out of there.
Yeah.
And once he starts to, you know, get out of there, well, then he's on the run, and then there is confusion because he doesn't know where to stop. Mm-hmm. But that was that night, and then I stayed with the unit for about 2 weeks with this hole in my face, and it was comical. I used to drink tea, and the liquid would run out the hole. It was about the size of your little finger. Mm-hmm. So a doctor that was there, our doctor, and I think he was a vet, told me that in time the thing would heal up and it would all fill back in. And one day I was driving down with a big bandage across my face, and I was stopped by a fellow that I knew in Italy who was a doctor, and he looked at me and he said, you know, to get back to a hospital as fast as I could, because he said, if that close to your brain idea, if that gets infected, you're in deep trouble.
Really?
So that I did, and I went back, and I was only in the hospital a day or 2 days, and they sewed it up again without anesthetic.
Well, why would they do that in England without anesthetic?
Well, this is in France.
Still in France.
No, I just, you know, when I say went to a hospital, we just went to the closest doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a, I've told this story 1,000 times to medical friends, but when I got back to where this doctor sent me, I met one of the surgeons, and it was one of those advanced surgical teams, and they had the hall of this building lined with patients, and he said, you know, they would try and fit me in when they could. I was not an emergency where there are people out there that were just, you know, damn sick. So one day I was, or the second morning I was there, and I just happened to see him in the hall. He said, come right in. He said, I just got time. They just wheeled a guy out of here. And so he said, jump up on the table. And then he said, there are 3 things I can do. He said, I can give you a major anesthetic and put you under and fix that up. But he said, that takes time, and we're awful short of time. He said, I'd give you a local. And he said, and sometimes a local on something as sensitive as your face and your lip like that, it might not work too well. And I know what he was leading up to, where he said, I could just do it without any anesthetic, and that's the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. And so he had me. I was on the table, and before you know it, he took out a great big knife, and he cored my lip like you'd take the core out of an apple. Now there's blood flying all over everything, and that, I nearly thought I was going to pass out then, but I didn't. And the next thing I look up, and he's got a like a big darning needle with a hook in it, and he put that through my face 4 times, in one side and out the other, 4 times, and then he pulled it together, tied it up, and as you can see, it's a first-class job.
I hadn't even noticed
it was dead center. Before. It's dead center. Yeah. And it was numb for about, oh, I'd say... a good 2 months. I had no feeling in my upper lip.
Did you faint at all from the...
No.
Painful.
Oh, when he's finished, he put a bandage over it, and he said, I'd suggest you go back and lie down. So, you know, I thought I was brave as hell, and I stood up and walked back to my room, and I happened to look in the mirror that was over a cot that was in there. My face was absolutely white. Mm-hmm. There was no color in it at all, and I lay down and I went sound asleep. But I can assure you, I wouldn't do that again. But anyway, we...
Well, how long were you in hospital then?
2 days.
And you were back to the unit?
And I went right back to the unit.
Because in the book it says you went back for hospitalization, period.
Yeah.
It doesn't specify, and I thought, well, geez, you must have gone back to England,
no,
France.
No, I didn't know where I went.
Yeah. Was it a Canadian hospital?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you got back to the unit.
So then I got back to the unit, and then we kept on going. Now we're up to Belgium. Mm-hmm. And what the hell did we do in Belgium? Oh, we had some exciting times in Belgium, but my friend that you just said, Amy and I, you know, had some exciting times there. One day we took a Jeep, and... again, it was very confusing as to where the enemy was and so on. Mm-hmm. And
was the weather good at this point?
Oh, yeah. It was in the fall.
Yeah, no rain?
No, dry. Mm-hmm. I can't remember where it was, but anyway, the unit was moving up. I'll have to retrace my steps here, but the unit was moving up. And I was just in a Jeep, and this particular day I drove up and finally got alongside his tank. And they were stopped in the middle of the road, and so I asked them what they were stopped for, and he said a Belgian, a local fellow, had come up and said there were Germans in all around them. Mm-hmm. So Amy got out of his tank, and the Belgian pointed to a barn, which is about 30 yards away, and he said, there are Germans in there. And so, foolishly, looking back, but the two of us ran over to the barn.
Mm-hmm. With pistols drawn?
Yeah, with a pistol drawn, and he said, why don't we throw a grenade in the door? It was a stone building, and which he did. There was nothing in the first part. Or if there was, nobody came out. So then we ran along the side, and you could see boots underneath this barn door. Mm-hmm. They were in there. Yeah. and they were across the way. So he fired a grenade into the building, and we never stopped anymore. It practically blew the door off. And then this Belgian said, come on, there are more of them over here. So we went along, and I guess in 20 minutes, it just absolutely luck. I think really they wanted to be taken prisoner more than fight. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact the tanks were all lined up in the road. I mean,
you could see them in the distance.
Oh God, in the distance, 50 yards away.
Yeah.
So to
Did
fight.
Did they try and surrender at all?
No, they didn't right there. And we, it got kind of. Well, we picked up we were taken prisoners by now,
mm-hmm.
and they had these machine pistols, those Schmeisser things. And we each had one of those, and we had about four or five clips of ammunition, and this guy was telling us where they were, and he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran across the road, and then we got another Belgian with us, and he was kind of taking the prisoners. And we went to run along, and I'll tell you, a German jumped up in front of me. If he was 10 feet away, I'd never seen him. Well, it all happened so quickly, and he was standing there with a rifle, and I was standing with his bloody thing. And I didn't know what else to say except two words that I learned, and that was just hand hawk,
mm-hmm.
which is hands up. And with that, he dropped his rifle and up with his hands. I don't know why. I guess it was who was going to shoot who.
Or who was more afraid of the other.
That's right. And there were two of us, and there was one in.
Yeah.
But we ran across the road, and again, there was kind of a building with some hay in it. And the Belgian, I couldn't understand him, but he's screaming that there's a whole flock of them in there. So we fired a grenade into this hay, and God, I don't know how many came out of there, out of that barn, but there were a lot, if I said 15. And in reality, we'd been standing within 10 feet of them.
Yeah.
But we threw the grenade up in the loft up above where there was nobody, but from the distance, the guy stood up just as close as from me, and they were all lying in this hay, and they'd covered themselves with hay.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say they really didn't want to fight, but they didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Were there any officers among them, or were they all
fighting? We didn't even look.
Yeah.
So we'd taken them all, and then we ran outside, and then something really comical happened. And now we've rounded them all up. They said we've got them all. So they go marching down the road, and there were some wounded ones too, but we weren't concerning ourselves with that. And now the local people came out. And then it got humorous because they invited us in, and people were crying and yelling and kissing us, and they invited us into the local little wine store, or I guess you'd say it, I'd say like a beer parlor place where only they had wine in.
Yeah.
Only this guy had been a collaborator.
Uh-huh.
So they said, these are collaborators. So away we go to the door, and they've got hold of him, and I don't know whatever happened to him, but they bust into the thing, and they got all the booze in the place, and all the local inhabitants, of which there are about 150, and they just bust the whole place up. So that was accomplished then. And then they took us down the street to another place, and this woman had not been a collaborator, but she had not done any business, because nobody would deal with her. So now the people are overjoyed, and they take all the booze from the first place to the second place. And that's where their party's going to be. So then we went back to our headquarters, and they invited us back that night for a dinner. So the two of us went back, and we get into this house, and lo and behold, they brought in, I think it was four American Air Force people that had been hiding in the town. The town people had them hidden,
mm-hmm.
and until we got there, so they came in. Well, that's a pretty emotional thing too. So the party raged on, and we finally stayed there all night, and got up in the morning and went back to the unit. And then the next day we had an equally fine thing, because I said the two of us got in a Jeep, and we drove over to a mansion. Really, it was an estate place, and you don't know what to expect. And we drove in, and I said, I'll go to the front door and you go to the back door.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like you'd see the cops and robbers now. But so we went to the front door, and I'm pounding on the door, and you can hear something inside. And lo and behold, round the corner he came with the man and his wife and two daughters. And it again was quite emotional. He was very high up in the Belgian government, and he'd gone back there. So they took us in the house. And this is hard to believe, but they all got there, and with what people crying and hanging on to you, then we all got in like a big dining room. Mm-hmm. And the mother said to the father, idea for him to sit there. And she sent one of the daughters away, and you won't believe this, but there had been two Air Force guys hiding up in the attic of this house, and they'd been there for some time. When I say some time, I'm thinking of a month or more. Mm-hmm. And the mother and the daughters had not told the father. So in the event, if somebody came around, they couldn't torture it out of him, because as far as he's concerned, there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. Well, if you can imagine that emotional scene then, because the old man didn't know whether to be mad at his wife or kiss her again. And so then they served us a big breakfast, and that was kind of, that was quite a day. Yeah. And then we went on to, and we finally got up to, I can't remember all the things that happened, but we got up to the is it the Maas River?
M-E-U-S-E? Maas and U-S-E?
I think so.
Yeah.
And we were on one side of that thing, and the Germans were on the other, and we shelled one another in time, but the war then stopped. Mm-hmm. For a period. Until we were moving up on New Year's Day, and I'm sure in the history there, the Germans sent over a hell of a lot of planes that morning. Mm-hmm. And really just raked the country with fire. And the night before, mind you, we'd been stationed up there, and there, we knew they were across the river, and we pulled up a whole squadron of tanks, and we'd been practicing this before, and so that we could zero in the guns and we could do indirect fire with them. Mm-hmm. If you fired one gun and we lined them all up, and at midnight we sent over one hell of a barrage of shells over there, so I'm sure they'll never forget that midnight, the guys that were there. Mm-hmm. And after that, we moved.
Well, can I stop you for a second? Because I know that in December you took command of the regiment.
Oh, this... Yeah. No, I didn't in December. Did I? I guess I did.
Well, it was in late 1944 anyway.
Yeah, I guess it was December. I can't remember when. Mm-hmm. And then we moved up.
Well, do you remember... I want to talk about that if we can.
Okay.
Do you remember the circumstances of it? Why were you elevated at that point? Who had been the commander before? Was the company?
Halpeny had been the commander before that. Mm-hmm. And he was sent back to England to a staff job, and I was promoted to the CO, and Major Amy was made the 2IC.
Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a natural progression, and they did that in regiments, didn't they, at that time?
Yes.
Yeah. Were you senior to Amy?
Well, we were both the same.
Yeah.
He's a year older than me, but seniority doesn't count too much there.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you want to pick up your story from there, I just wanted to put...
I don't know, we just... that was in the winter of 44, and we were involved, although we never got into the fighting. When the Germans broke through at Ardennes, we moved, the division moved and so on, but as it happened, the advance was stopped before we were required to do anything.
But I suppose you were rushed into that area between Antwerp and where the Germans were.
That's right.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah. So we were up there really for a matter of 6 weeks or so on, and then you get back down to now the spring of 45, and I guess the first major battle we're going into is when I get wounded. Mm-hmm. As the unit, in
and that
spring.
Was in Holland, wasn't it?
No, now we're in Germany.
You're in Germany proper now?
Yeah.
Across the Rhine?
No, this side of the Rhine.
This side of the Rhine.
We're in the Hochwald Forest, mm-hmm. just outside there. A place called Udem. U-D-E-M. Mm-hmm. And the division was broken down into various groups, and I was in command of one of them. And
did it consist of more than your regiment alone?
Yeah, our regiment, we had infantry. I can't remember whether they were, I think they were in carriers, in personnel carriers.
What are the famous kangaroos?
Yeah, I think that was who they were there. I can't even remember that now. But we started across in the early morning, and I have no idea what time I got wounded, but I'm guessing it was around 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the circumstances?
Well, it was flat ground, mm-hmm, with trees and farms, you know, fairly flat and fairly open, but, you know, very tough country to be going through if somebody wants to defend it, because you can't see anything. When you're advancing, you're just going forward, and somebody's going to get hit. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to know where the other guy is, and then the battle starts, I did.
But the fellow who's going to get the first shot is hidden, and
he's got the first shot, always. Yeah. Really, I mean, he should have anyway, because he's getting ready for you.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in our case, and they knocked out about 3 tanks in a row very quickly, just bang, bang, bang.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them, which I was in, and then I don't know what happened after that, but obviously they saw where the fire was coming from,
mm-hmm,
and they nullified that fall. And then the unit continued on. We were very close to our objective then. I think we were within about 1,000 feet of the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say your objective, it just seemed to be you're going to end up to the next row of trees.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a wild place to be in.
You were in the lead tank, I take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you got popped off first. Did the tank brew up immediately, or was it a... And you were at the top?
It brewed up, and I, of course, lost my leg.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can remember is that when I got hit, all at once, I looked up, and the thing is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking right up to the turret, which you can see daylight, but it's like looking into a cone of fire.
So where was it coming from? The outside?
No, all inside. It's burning inside.
Yeah? And you were inside it?
Mm-hmm. So I'm on the floor.
Yeah.
So I went to stand up, and I fell down again, because I don't know what the hell's wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I didn't have long to get out of there. So I literally pulled myself up the wall, the inside of the tank,
mm-hmm,
and got my head outside, and so I could breathe. And then I just slowly but surely pulled myself over, and I fell in the back of the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, I saw my leg was shot off.
Completely?
Well, 95% of it. Just your foot was hanging dangling on the end, but the bones are all gone.
Well, what had happened? Had the shell gone through it?
Gone through the tank. And I jumped down on the ground then and rolled over, and the only thing I did, which I guess was vital to me, I took the boot lace out of my other boot,
mm-hmm,
and I tied it as tight as I bloody well could tie it around my leg. Do you follow me?
As a tourniquet.
And I'm sure that saved my life, because, you know, in a time like that, you know, you're bleeding something vicious, you know, and those are the big arteries in your body, and it's not going to take long to run out of
blood.
So I did that, and then they everything quieted down, it seemed to me, and then they lifted me onto a...
You were conscious throughout all this?
Oh, yeah. They lifted me onto a kind of a scout, or a light tank, I guess you'd call it. They had a little turret on it. And I kind of hung on the side of that thing, and they also loaded on other casualties, and that guy took us back.
Did any of the other fellows in your tank make it out? Or?
They all got out.
Did they?
Yeah, one guy was very badly burnt. But the rest got out. I guess I was the heaviest casualty, other than the fellow that got burnt. But he lived.
Was it unusual to have a full tank crew make it out of a brew up? Because it was an 80.
Well, sometimes they all get out, and sometimes none of them get out.
Depends where the shell hits and how it hits.
I saw a tank one time. They hit it, and they must have hit it, you know, in the ammunition or something. And it blew the turret, I guess, about 20 feet in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, nobody got it out of that one.
Yeah.
And a turret must weigh at least 7 tons. I imagine the explosion. It took it right off.
Shot it in the air?
Yeah, right up.
Well, after you got out of it, did yours blow up?
No, it just kept burning.
Yeah.
They wouldn't shoot at it again. They know that they've, you know, immobilized it or
but
knocked
it
out.
Fuel or the ammunition or anything like that?
Oh, it'll, you know, if you watch them when they're burning, I've seen lots of them burn, and they, no, they, some ammunition keep blowing up an hour from now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. The hot metal will just...
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's nothing the same about any two of them, except they just seem to brew away. That's what they say, a tank's brewing up, and it is brewing. It just slowly burns, and it burns itself out. It burns itself out of gas, oil,
or any other thing.
Anything else that's inflammable.
Yeah. But I guess by that time, you was long since gone.
Oh, I've gone. Oh, yeah.
I suppose that was your ticket out. You went back to the hospital in France and probably England.
No, I went back to the first hospital, and they operated on me there. I don't know where it was, my dad, I haven't the slightest idea. It was in a school, I know that, and there were guns around the place, because they were firing the bloody guns, and it sounded like the all hell broke loose in there. And they operated on me, and I came to the next morning. I think I was there two nights.
Mm-hmm.
There again, I'm not just too sure. And then they put us in an ambulance, a British ambulance, and there were four of us in there. And they are the most awful things that ever happened. Whoever built them, they should take them out and get rid of him, because there's no springs in them.
No suspension.
Oh, the suspension. There were four of us in there, and one guy, I think he died.
Because of the rough ride?
Well, he just screamed forever. And they stopped, and well, there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where we went to. We went somewhere, obviously, and we stayed overnight, and then the next day... We got onto a cargo plane, and they flew us back to England. And then when we got to England, I have no idea where we landed, and we were taken by ambulance to a hospital, and I was in the 1st Canadian General at Cuckfield.
Whereabouts is that?
In this, about 50 miles from Brighton, down the southern England. And that was, I was wounded on the 26th of February. I would say I got there about the 1st of March.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there all March, all April, and the best part of May. Well, I was there till the war was over. That was after May.
Mm-hmm.
And then got on a hospital ship and came home.
At the hospital itself, was a Canadian hospital?
Yes.
Was it Canadian nurses, Canadian sisters?
All Canadian staff, 100%.
Treated well there?
Oh, wonderful. First class. Couldn't be better.
Did you get out at all, or were you bedridden most of the time?
Oh, hell, I was up